Good afternoon. Let's call this meeting of the House Health and Social Service Committee to order. It is 3:04, and February 21st, 2013. Present is Representative Keller, Representative Reinbold, and Representative Higgins. That's me. Let's do a little bit of housekeeping. We have a full room today, which I truly do appreciate. Anyone with cell phones, though, if you could please turn them off. We don't want to hear any ringing. We have a standing order in this room. If your cell phone does ring, you have to go get us donuts. That's everybody. So let's try to keep them down if we could. Today we're going to excuse Representative Nygak for today. He is not in. Butch Carver, which is our House Recording Secretary. Claire Gross, which is our LIO moderator. My committee aide is Paul Verhagen. If you need anything, just wave to him. He'll come to you and see what you need and see if he can assist you with anything. So, with that said, and Representative Tarr just joined us.
Thank you. Chairman.
Today we have two presentations and one bill to be heard. We'll start our first presentation will be by the Alaska Brain Injury Network. And I want to say that I appreciate the brain. I've been squeezing on it for half a day. So yeah, I appreciate that. And, well, we'll invite those that are presenting the Alaska Brain Network to come forward and have them introduce themselves and their names and their positions for the record, and then we can begin the presentation. And one more thing, and you guys can answer this. If we have questions, would you like us to hold them, or do you want us to ask them as we do the presentation? What's up to you?
I think it'll be easier and better for recollection if we do it
as we go. Okay, sounds good. So those questions will be told through the chair. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Trenin. For the record, my name is Jill Hodges. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
My name is Roland Torres. I'm a newcomer to Alaska. I'm a neurosurgeon at the Alaska Native Medical Center.
And I'm Pat Chapman from Ketchikan. I host the Traumatic Brain Injury Support Group, but I'm here today speaking for my daughter, 24, Jessie. She's had a brain injury, and because of that, she couldn't be here. She was wiped out for meetings this morning. So I apologize for her, but that's life.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did just want to share that we have quite a big group here, but a few of them are board members of the Alaska Brain Injury Network, so I was hoping that our board members could stand, and I would like to introduce Dr. Mary Page Lucas. She is our board chair. Yes, and there might be a few people on the phone that are listening in as well, but today we're here to shine a light on brain injuries, and really it's about brain injury care in Alaska and the lack thereof. And so I know that medical things might be new or brain injury might be new, so please ask any questions. So why worry about brain injury? Well, because it happens a lot. And as you can see, this is national prevalence, traumatic brain injuries compared to a few other medical conditions that you might be a little more familiar with, breast cancer, HIV, AIDS, etc. But another reason to really pay attention to brain injury is this is a group that has a lot of potential for recovery and for really improving after they've had a traumatic brain injury. And it has a lot of opportunity for cost savings down the line, and I'll get to some of those slides here in a second. So what is traumatic brain injury? Well, traumatic brain injury happens when you get hit by something or you hit something. And the top right slide here is my brother. Back in 2005, I was called back to California because he had a fall. And at the time, I didn't know why I'd be taking this picture. I just thought it'd be good to take this picture. This is Clayton after he got out of his coma, and he's here resting with his friend. And, you know, there's this whole spectrum of brain injury. You also have sports concussions, and a lot of us hear about sports concussions, and we're hearing about brain injury in the military with mild TBI. So we're looking at a whole host of different severities. So what we know, and these are just a few facts, The Alaska Trauma Registry shows that we have about 680 Alaskans hospitalized each year. So those are pretty significant injuries. Average, we have potentially about 3,000 people, Alaskans, that visit the emergency department and go home the same day. And so I asked the Alaska Trauma Registry, since we've been tracking, how many total hospitalizations have we had here in the state of Alaska? And for 1991 to 2011, close to 15,000 Alaskans have been hospitalized with those moderate injuries. And as you can see the slide here, over a five-year period, this shows where do people go once they leave the hospital. And that large blue section there is home without assistance. And Dr. Torres is really going to speak to why that's happening here in the state. We have a few cost figures. Dr. Torres is going to speak to those as well. But I did want to highlight what we also know about brain injury, where over the last 10 years, the state of Alaska really has taken a leadership role in being able to ask questions around brain injury. And what we've learned is that the behavioral health system, through AK Ames, it's their screening tool, about 34% of new behavioral health clients are screening positive for head injury. There's homeless. I know that House Finance Committee members heard from Jeff Jesse from the Mental Health Trust Authority, but there's a large percentage of the homeless that are potential brain injury. Same with corrections and same with our juvenile justice. And so really we're trying to show what happens if we have this huge gap in our brain injury care system. And to give you a glimpse, yep.
Just let the record indicate that Representative Seaton just showed up. Thank you. You're welcome. Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. And to give you a glimpse of what does a traumatic brain injury continuum of care look like, it's anywhere from emergency evaluation, emergency department, neuro, specialty neuro, and then you get to this rehab, inpatient or outpatient, and then you get to supported living. And once we get to the specialty neuro trauma, this is pretty much where it stops in Alaska. And it's really, really hard to imagine how can we miss this whole section when it comes to brain injury. And hopefully Dr. Torres could talk a little bit about that a little bit further. But this next slide shows, I know it's hard to see, and I don't know if it made it into your slides, but we did this a few years ago. We talked to the tribal system, the private system like Providence Regional, the VA, and then also the DOD system, and trying to develop kind of a continuum of what exists here in the state. And among all those systems, none of them have the post-acute or lifelong kind of services for brain injury.
Yeah, that slide didn't make it into our package, at least not in mine, so.
Okay, great. We have a brochure on that. I could get that to you.
Okay, that would be great. That we can hand it out to the committee members.
Okay, great. Thank you. I guess I want to back up to this piece right here before I go on a little. I'd just like to highlight that brain injury is a medical condition, but also it's a chronic condition. You can rehabilitate, you can recover, but for many, it's a lifelong thing that you're managing. And so to treat it in the medical model is important, but also to understand it as a chronic condition is also very important. So one of the opportunities we have is to create this system. And we now have experts like Dr. Roland Torres that really have the expertise who have done this in other states. And we really hope that this is more than a building. This is a system of care. It's anywhere from improving the trauma system down the line.
Let's go back to the other slide.
Okay.
That one there. Does not exist in Alaska. What do you mean by that?
Well, it does not exist in Alaska.
There is not one facility, sir, in the state of Alaska which addresses brain injury once they've been saved in the hospital and ready for discharge.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that for me and the audience,
okay,
how important that is out there. Because a lot of people think that there are, you know, some homes or some service of some sort. So when you've got a statement, does not exist, that's a pretty strong statement.
Absolutely. And that's absolutely the truth.
Okay. Thank you for pointing that out. So really, what is the catch? Well, policy and payment really is going to be essential. And there's quite a few recommendations, anywhere from states of mandated insurance to pay for this type of care, traumatic brain injury waivers. There are 24 states that have a traumatic brain injury Medicaid waiver. There's designated funds through DUI fines, so on and so forth. And so this really is a piece that just for education purposes.
We have a question. Representative Vrabel?
Excuse me, you said 24 states had a Medicaid waiver. Do we?
No.
24 states have a Medicaid waiver specifically for traumatic brain injury, and we do not.
Okay, so our Medicaid does pay for TBI?
We have four waivers, and there are some Alaskans that make it onto those waivers. There are some people with TBI who make it onto those waivers, but a TBI waiver is pretty specific to the functional limitations that someone with a brain injury has. It's only if you have a significant physical disability or if you're a child with complex needs that you really make it onto those waivers. And one of the challenges with the waivers is it doesn't always pay for the rehabilitation component, and Pat could speak to that because her daughter was on a children with complex medical conditions waiver for many years and tried to get rehab through that, and it wasn't easy. And really here with the Brain Injury Network, we're here to educate, plan, coordinate, but I did just want to highlight one of our board members. He might be on the phone, but Lel Venta is one of our founding board members, and in reading his bio, I thought I'd just share it with you. Lel Venta is one of the board's founding members. He doesn't like labels, and he doesn't like to talk about himself. So we were all surprised at a meeting at Alyeska when he offhandedly remarked that he had run the power lines to the ski resort and all the lifts. A coincidence? Well, not really. Several decades ago, Lel ran power lines virtually all over Alaska, over mountains, through valleys, remote communities, and even on the ocean floor. A craving for adventure and hard work lured Lel to some of the most dangerous and physically demanding occupations Alaska has to offer, from fishing to logging to construction to explosives and everything in between. When one day he dropped out of a lift and sustained a head injury, he was just doing his job. Lel misses his ballroom dancing, speed skating, running and skiing, you name it. But one thing that didn't change in his life was his drive to help others. And that's one of the reasons that he supports the Alaska Brain Injury Network. And we have many partners you could see on this slide. And really one of the things we'd like to share today is that brain injury really hurts Alaskans. We have a lot of work around prevention, this acute care component, post-acute rehab. And really it's our veterans, our emergency responders, our workers, those who are assaulted really deserve this care, and so do our families. And that's why I'm so thankful that Pat is here to share her story on how this affects Pat and her family and many more Alaskans.
Be next. Hi, I'm Pat Chapman, and this is my daughter. This is actually my biological granddaughter, but I adopted her at birth and raised her. This is a beautiful young lady. She was 17, was an AP student, heading to college in just a few months. She was in a car accident, a rollover car accident that eliminated her life. And if she was here, part of her story is that she is not the same person. She will never be that person, and she's just now, 7 years down the road, realizing that she's never going to be this Jessie Chapman that was going off to college to do fabulous things and come back to Alaska. She's not sure who she's going to be, but she knows she's going to be somebody, and she's going to get an education somehow. Jessie was a quad mute, and the system figured she would never wake up, never speak, never walk, never use her hands. And if you can kind of see in the picture there, that one part where her hands are all curled up a little bit, her hands are now being used. And I have to thank the state and my private insurance for doing the physical operations. I mean, they were super about helping get her care that she needed for physical. They can see the physical damage. What we can't get and have not got is care for the brain. The therapy that she needed to be able to control her emotions. As her body starts physically getting better, she wants to do things, but her brain doesn't work. Getting her brain to tell her feet to pick up to move is a lot of work, and it's a lot of strain. And you know how tired you are after 8 hours of work? Well, within an hour of her, she's tired. She's had 8 hours. She was here this morning testifying, and by 11 o'clock, she was worn out. She had to go back to the hotel. If not, she would have a complex behavior problem. And when she explodes, she explodes. In September, I could not have brought her up here. In September of 2012, that kid would ruin this room and not even realize that she was exploded. I tried to find help in the state of Alaska, and I could not get neuropsychology help for her. We live in Ketchikan. I can't even get psychiatric help for her. I went out of state on my own dollars to find with my insurance. I coerced them into it because the other option is send her up here to API. I had her in the University of Washington, and I took her to the psychiatric ward because she blew out down there. And they said, Pat, this is not where she belongs. She needs traumatic brain injury therapy. She has a brain injury. She's not mentally incapacitated. She does not have a mental illness that we can treat. She needs a specialty. So I went to Lakeview in Waterford, Wisconsin, and my insurance paid for 10 weeks there. This is a beautiful young person that came back. I missed her. We should not have had to send her away from home to get this kind of therapy. We should have had it here in Alaska. But I sent her there, and I done without her, and I worried every night what was going on with my baby. I finally had to go get her back because my insurance said, hey, we can't afford it anymore. The state Medicaid would not pay for it. They did not pay for that kind of therapy, and especially out of state. So I brought her home. She does have some tools, and I am so proud of those tools because she can come up here to Juneau. She could go in and testify what she did today, where she could not have before. And I really, really encourage you to look at providing services here in the state. I could give you stories. I work in the emergency department, and I see kids coming through. And I also host the traumatic brain injury support group there in Ketchikan. And some people, a minor sports injury changes a whole young person's life. The potential is there. Not everybody does. But that one person that it changes takes that one young person out of the workforce to take care of me in my older age. You know, I want him working and taking care of the services here in the state. And instead, that young person now is on state aid and is in API or Bartlett, because we did not give them the therapy that they needed when they were injured. And I don't mean to take a lot of time up, but I really, really encourage you to look into the complex behavior program and giving services. Let's provide something here in the state of Alaska.
And if you don't mind, for my education and maybe for others, what did they do with her?
They did a complete therapy program. There was neuropsychology, there was psychiatric care, there was speech therapy, and she come back speaking. There was occupational therapy, there was physical therapy, and there was independent living skills too. But that, she didn't need so much the independent skills, but she needed the physical therapy because she had frustration right with that. She needed the speech, and the speech did wonderful with her.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for allowing us to speak here today. I guess I have the last part of this talk, and this is me in a previous life. Until about 4 months ago, I was a professor of neurosurgery as well as the director of neurotrauma at Stanford University in Northern California. When we talk about head injury, there's a lot of different criteria that are used in many different kinds of head injury. The trauma care fund that has been provided for here since 2010 has been a great start. What's been happening, for example, at the Alaska Native Medical Center, which is your highest level trauma center, they're providing trauma care coverage 24/7. They've acquired cell saver equipment. They're providing ATLS training. That's advanced trauma life support training for the many of the community and as well as the rest of the hospitals and institutions of the state of Alaska. Also trauma nurse care courses, trauma quality improvements, and Trauma Center Association memberships. This is where your money's going. But since then, since you started this project, unfortunately that's not showing up very well, there are 13 more centers that have applied for or have been converted into a certified level 3, level 4 trauma centers. So the point is that with $2 million, it's not really as much as it could be, and certainly it's needed for the state. You can't see it up here, unfortunately, but since I came, we've established the Think First chapter. That's a national organization for injury prevention for head and spinal cord injury. We're providing neurotrauma care and neurocritical care for nurses at the in the Anchorage Bowl for clinical expertise. We've upgraded a bunch of equipment in the hospital to be able to diagnose and treat vascular injuries. There's a full-time trauma register. We recently, in the last week, received a letter from the American College of Surgeons verifying that we are recertified for another 3 years. I mentioned that trauma comes in a variety of bewildering presentations, from your standard epidural hematoma, your intracerebral hematoma, your diffuse axonal injury, subdural hemorrhages, intraventricular hemorrhages, and the kind of injury that you see frequently here in Alaska in the wintertime when people fall through rivers or frozen lakes, et cetera, hypoxic injuries. What's the burden of neurological emergencies here? Across the country, this is a relatively recent slide. When we look at this, the cost of traumatic brain injury and acute care is hundreds of thousands of dollars in initial hospitalization. The average is $136,000 for traumatic brain injury, for spinal cord injury, $200,000, for subarachnoid hemorrhages, $228,000. When we look at payers for traumatic brain injury hospitalizations from 2007 to 2011, all comers, all races in Alaska, we have a breakdown of approximately 3,400 admissions to the tune of about $145 million. That's your health care dollars. The annual cost of TBI in the United States, this is an older slide now from a bunch of talks that I've had in the past couple of years, it's now equal to about $100 billion a year in health care dollars. When we look at the high-risk populations, who's at risk, young people, low-income individuals, unmarried individuals, members of ethnic minority groups, residents of inner cities, men, unfortunately, almost always 2-to-1 versus women, individuals with previous history of substance abuse, individuals with previous TBI. Trauma in Alaska, it's the leading cause of death under age 44. It's the second highest trauma mortality in the entire United States. About 500 Alaskans die each year from head injury. Over 1,000 are permanently disabled. And there are approximately 5,000 admissions a year now. Look at this graph. The blue line down here, the bottom line, is the trauma mortality in the United States, all 49 states. When we look at the magenta or pink colored line, it's all Alaskans. And then when we look at the yellow line, which is huge, it's Alaska Natives. The incidence rate per your own Division of Behavioral Health of identified traumatic injuries in Alaska is 28% higher than the national rate. Each year, 244 persons are hospitalized for traumatic brain injury just in the Anchorage Bowl alone. That's Anchorage in the Matsu region. One out of four injured was under the influence of alcohol. Almost half are under age 30. When we talk about trauma systems in general, and this is an article from the New England Journal, 1999, there's about a 15 to 20% improvement in survival of the seriously injured when you have an organized trauma system. This inclusive systems are the best. They increase productive working years and improve statewide disaster preparedness as well. When we look at the impact of trauma systems in San Diego, in Los Angeles, in Tampa, Florida, before and after. Blue is before the trauma system was instituted, and the brown or tan is after. In San Diego, it's roughly 15% mortality rate or preventable deaths. It goes below 5%. In Los Angeles, a huge megalopolis, 35% before and about 15% afterwards. In Tampa, Florida, where there's been a huge crime rate, almost 25% versus nearly 5%. When Bob Smith and his group looked at the impact of trauma centers over a two-year period in the Chicago trauma system, they examined 1,643 trauma patients treated at 7 trauma centers. Right? Patients taken to a low-volume trauma center had a 30% greater chance of dying. When we look at Ellen McKenzie's group from Hopkins, these are big epidemiologists, they evaluated the effect of trauma center care on mortality. Going to a trauma center versus a non-trauma center, it causes a difference of 50% mortality rate. You have a 50% greater chance of dying. When you look at indirect transfer, as Roger Hartle and Jan Gajar, who's now the president of the Brain Trauma Foundation in New York, they looked at indirect trauma evidence, class 2 evidence, that shows a 50% increase in mortality associated with indirect transfer of traumatic brain injury patients. The impact of a trauma system on outcome, this is a hypothetical model of predicted survival was 18%. Using a trauma system, actual survival was 29%. When we look at trauma patients at the University of Virginia, ISS score is greater than 15. That's severely injured patients presenting to UVA. Directly transported patients had a shorter ICU, shorter total hospital stays overall. So, again, the Hopkins people put out this interesting article, Cost-Benefit Analysis of Testing the Brain Trauma Foundation Guidelines. These are guidelines for how to manage severely head-injured patients and their treatment. And what they did was they took a hypothetical state where they had 7,000 deaths. By adopting the Brain Trauma Foundations, they presumed or the hypothesis showed that they would save about 3,600 lives. There's direct medical costs, there's rehabilitation costs, there's societal costs. But overall, the savings was about $4 billion per state, per hypothetical state, by adoption of guidelines in the trauma system. So the last part of this talk is about patients that I personally have taken care of just in the last 3 months alone and what's happened to them. 34-year-old male with a subdural had surgery and severe traumatic brain injury, that did well after 12 days, was ready for discharge. Was in the hospital for over 40 days because of lack of funding and availability of a rehab facility in the state of Alaska. Case number two, 59-year-old who had a severe brainstem hemorrhage. She was in the hospital almost 100 days, even though she was ready for discharge after 3 weeks. Why? Again, funding and the lack of availability of a neuro rehab facility in the state of Alaska. Number three, a 66-year-old from Bethel with a subarachnoid hemorrhage and severe TBI. Again, ready for discharge in about 2 to 3 weeks, but was the overall length of stay was 73 days, again, because of the lack of availability of a neuro rehab facility in the state of Alaska. Number four, chronic subdural hematoma from a severe TBI. Again, no neuro rehab center in Alaska. These are all patients that have similar stories, or alternatively, a lack of availability of inpatient psychiatric care. The API wouldn't take these last couple of patients. This young man tried to shoot himself, was not successful. We saved him. He was very high functioning. He had very minimal damage from his gunshot wound to the head. API refused to take him. I had to complain to the state at many different levels before they finally saw him. Number seven, three-year-old who was in the hospital for 3 weeks and 32 days later was finally accepted to Seattle Children's Hospital for rehab for long-term physical and the problem was long-term physical and financial support and no pediatric rehab in the state of Alaska. When you look at funding, common funding for California, for Illinois, and I brought these up because they have the bigger funds and the more sophisticated systems. Even Mississippi uses taxes and car and driver charges. When we look at Pennsylvania, most of it comes from traffic fines and criminal fines. When you look at Florida, they use sales tax in addition to traffic fines. California, traffic fines, property tax, state general fund. Illinois, traffic fines. I think you see a system. Everybody's using or applying traffic fines, DWI fines, and this is really where the majority of the trauma funds are happening. Your trauma fund is $2 million here in the state of Alaska per year, $25 million, $18 million in Florida, $25 in California, $13 in Illinois. It varies in Maryland. Washington itself, $32 million. The state of Georgia, $80 million trauma fund a year. Thank you.
Wow. Well, what an eye-opener. You know, you read that and you go through it. But I do, you know, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
You went through the length of stay of some of these patients, 88 days in the hospital. While they were in the hospital for that 88 days, were they getting some sort of treatment to help them get through this? Is that what?
They were getting some sort of minimal but not specialized treatment. We're talking about specialized rehabilitative comprehensive programs where they have, as Mrs. Chapman mentioned, psychiatry, right, social services, rehab specialists, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, activities. They're shown activities of daily living. That you can't do it without all these staff.
And who coordinates that while they're in there, in the hospital? I mean, who makes sure they're getting what they need?
Well, they're typically rehab facilities or rehab hospitals, and so the rehabilitative, physical and medicine rehabilitative doctors.
I see. Okay.
So it's subspecialists.
Any questions from the committee?
No? I guess I could ask one. I know a lot of kids who have ended up either hockey or football injuries. I have teenage boys, so I'm around this a lot. I'm just wondering what percentage of these injuries are, I see you have neurological ones, things like that, but are kids?
So, I don't, you know the answer to, in Alaska, the number is?
I don't have the exact incidence, but I could pull it up for you and get that to you.
I'd just be interested in sports injuries. I know they have all these movies and all this that they have to watch. I'm not sure, you know, the impact that it's having, but I know this is a very serious. And I know Elmendorf has a fantastic brain.
They've got a brain injury program. So Alaska Native Medical Center has changed in the last year since I've arrived. Number one, we've opened up the doors to all individuals who have an acute injury. Okay, it's no longer natives versus non-natives because some things are too important not to share, and we're creating a specialized center there. The Elmendorf folks are partnering up with us. I'm seeing all the TRICARE folks as well. We've partnered up with ABIN, and most importantly, we're trying to really get the state of Alaska to embrace a true trauma system. I think I mentioned before that the trauma system here falls below the standard of care in that in all other 49 states, every patient that is severely injured goes to a trauma center directly. Okay? In this state, it goes to the quote-unquote hospital that is closest to them. And that makes absolutely no sense because if you have to transfer them to another hospital where there's neurosurgical capability, now you, as you saw in the slides, increase your chances of dying by 30%.
May I address the sports issue some?
Go right on ahead.
A lot of our sports injuries are what we call moderate, mild to moderate, and they're sent home within 24 hours, if not less, without any follow-up, mm-hmm. and there is no follow-up for them in the state of Alaska.
And that's actually a good point, because I sit on the board for the Pop Warner people as well as one of the NFL teams, and it has to do with concussion. They're all looking at concussion right now. Mm-hmm. That's mild head injury. So the reality is that medicine and science doesn't really know what the cumulative effects will be. But that's being presently studied right now. So as much as I'd love to answer your question, the answer is not really out there yet.
Well, go ahead, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask, you said that right now the trauma fund that we have for the state of Alaska is $2 million per year.
Correct.
But that's significantly less than any of the states provided in your examples. Do you have an idea of what the amount would be, you know, necessary to meet the need in our state?
Well, you have 13 hospitals now that are partaking in the trauma system or trying to partake in the trauma system. So I think that a reasonable figure, and I hate to say this in light of the needs to cut the operational budget, but probably $3 to $4 million would be very useful to continue to grow the trauma system in Alaska.
Okay. Thank you. We appreciate your presentation, and it was, for me, an eye-opener on the need and what we need to do. And, you know, we'll take it under advisement as we look at our budgets and what we have to do. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next presentation. Thank you once again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see here. Well, our second presentation will be by the Key Coalition, correct? Excellent. And I see you're already at the table. So if you'll give your names and your positions, we can begin the presentation.
My name is Seth Kelly. I'm the Executive Director at Focus.
My name is Christina Santa Cross, and I'm a mother of two children with autism.
My name is Jim Beck, and I'm the Executive Director at Access Alaska.
Okay.
And my name is Lizette Steer, and I am the president of the Association of the 17 Statewide Infant Learning Programs, and I'm also an employee at Focus.
Okay. So as we go through the presentation, do you want us to hold our questions to the end or as we go, if we have questions?
As you go.
As we go? Okay. And we'll do that through the chair. The floor is yours.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Not only am I the executive director at Focus, but I'm a very, very proud member of the Key Campaign Coalition. And this is our 26th year, and through the work that we've done on our end and definitely the partnerships that we've had at the state, we've gotten a lot accomplished. The decisions you guys make here affect people very powerfully, and I do not envy you for the situation that you're in, but I find myself very often proud of the decisions you do make, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Today, the language bill, House Bill 88, I just want to thank everybody who has supported that and voted for that. Changing the language means a great deal to everybody, and it treats us all with respect, so thank you for that as well. We do have priorities. The priority that I want to speak to is the Complex Behavioral Collaborative. This is a program that's been in place for about a year now that brings in experts from around the country and also coordinates experts that we have in this state. Currently, we're asking for $450,000 to keep this program moving. This is a trust recommendation. The program pulls in experts to work with people who have behavior issues that are beyond what either our agencies or natural supports can deal with. What we've found through these experts coming in, we've actually decreased the cost of services by up to 50% from what they've received prior to this this planning and this work. The key part to the Complex Behavior Collaborative is not that the experts come in here and then they leave, it's that they train us all and they build up our infrastructure so that eventually we will have our own experts on site and being able to deal with these problems as they come up. One story that I do want to share with you is a story about Issa. She is a young woman who receives services here at REACH. Issa is 10 years old. She has an engaging laugh and a beautiful smile. She also has autism. She has many things to say, and she mostly uses gestures and body language to express herself. And when she can't make herself understood, she screams. She screams loud and for extended periods of time. She also screams when she is in pain, which is frequent because of migraine headaches, which have many triggers such as certain smells or too much sensory input. She will also bite and hit herself repeatedly or hit, kick, grab whoever is near. One direct service professional after another tried to work with her, but left after just a few days. Issa seriously injured her case manager, who would provide assistance when there weren't staff available. It was unclear how to turn the situation around. So a referral was made to the Complex Behavior Collaborative in December. Issa now has a staff person who has been with her for over a month. She's able to come into the REACH office and ask for an apple, saying the word apple and then signs thank you. She still has bad days, but when the migraines hit, there's a plan. And now there is hope. And there are stories like this all across the state. At our agency, we have used this service a couple of times so far, and it has made dramatic improvements in the individual's life and in the families that are supporting these kids. This Complex Behavior Collaborative as well can extend out to people who are older, dementia, traumatic brain injury, like you just heard. So this is really a statewide problem solver right here. So thank you very much.
Hi. I'm going to read because I'm not so eloquent. I can't just spit it out. Like I said, I'm a single mother of two children with autism, and sorry, I'm emotional. And I'm sure you guys are used to somebody sitting here telling you what you're doing wrong or what they need, but I'm here to thank you for passing the Autism Insurance Reform Bill last year. I'm the mother of two young children with autism, both completely different and both fall at different spots on the spectrum, but both require similar therapies that up until January I wasn't able to provide for them. I fought for years to try and get my kids ABA therapy, and each time was met with roadblocks. I paid a monthly insurance premium of $990 a month, and what my kids needed the most simply was not covered. The out-of-pocket expense for what they needed would have been $3,000 per week per child. At the end of January, my son started in-home ABA therapy through Focus. A week and a half into his therapy, my son played patty cake with me for the very first time ever. A week and a half, not a year, just a week and a half. And patty cake doesn't seem like a big deal, but in my world, it's huge. He's engaging and he's using functional play, which is the first stepping stone to learning. My daughter started ABA therapy this week, and as I'm up here telling you guys thank you. She's probably at home screaming at her therapist. But that's okay, because that means it's working. Just last week, my son began signing I love you to me. Now imagine having a child that was not equipped to tell you I love you until age 4. Now imagine that times 2. That's the boat I'm in. Him signing I love you to me was no coming of age factor. It was no coincidence. It was the direct result of intense, extensive, effective therapy treatment. Change happens at the intersection of courage and compassion, and I want to thank you all for your courage and your compassion, but above all else, for this wonderful gift. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a hard one to follow. My name is Jim Beck, as I said, and much of what we discuss here today is also really personal to me. I was spinal cord injured in a car accident in 1982, and I understand what it means to try to rebuild your life and reach for that independence and the control over our destinies that all of us value and that we are all reaching for. One of the priorities that I want to talk about is an employment priority. And as a person with a disability who advocates for independence all the time, I like to say that employment is the highest expression of independence that anybody can have, but particularly folks with disabilities. And my brothers and sisters with disabilities experience upwards of 70% unemployment in America, which is really a shame. We have a lot to offer. Folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities typically have even a higher rate of employment. So we have a priority and a request that we are looking for a champion for, which is a $500,000 increment that would be part of the community developmental disability system. It would be focused at young people with developmental disabilities to provide supported employment services. And supported employment services have been shown to dramatically decrease ongoing and long-term benefit use by people with disabilities, and have always shown to provide a better quality of life and turn people into more productive tax-paying citizens rather than people who spend their life on benefits not being productive. So we strongly support this increment. It's not in the governor's budget or in any budget yet, but it's a priority that we're going to continue to talk about because of the importance of it. One of the really neat things about the idea is that of the $500,000 we're looking at, $50,000 of that will be used for peer support. And what that means is that we have a number of really wonderful folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities who already work, who will help young people as role models and as peers to show what can be done and that you can have a life as a person with a developmental disability and you can work. So that's a really important part of this request. The other one that I would like to discuss is the wait list for folks with developmental disabilities, the registry as we call it. And this is another good news story. The State Division of Senior and Disability Services has been working very diligently and has drawn that list down from a high of about 1,500 people down to about 635 right now. They're, every month they draw 17 to 20 people or so for the waivers, which is a very good thing because that leverages federal dollars and it helps us to pay for really good quality services for these folks. So we just want to make sure that the legislature is aware of the success and that you guys do everything you can to support senior and disability services as they continue to work away at that list, because I'm sure you share our belief that we'd like to see a zero population wait list. And again, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned, I'm here representing the infant learning program statewide, but much more importantly, I'm here representing the thousands of families that we've worked with over that literally decades of this program. As we're all experiencing evolution of finances and evolution in programs, infant learning is evolving too. And part of that evolution is out of the brain research, and I'm sure you've all heard the brain research about how critical the first 3 years are, and that has really come home to roost for us. But the newest brain research is really showing the critical impact that trauma, violence, neglect have on a child's brain development. And there's a very powerful video I wish I had to show you of an intervention in a home where violence had just taken place. The 7-year-old is totally zoned out watching the TV. The 5-year-old girl is convinced that it's her fault,
And the baby, who was asleep in the back room, everybody thought was, of course, the one person that did not experience any trauma out of this traumatic spaghetti on the wall, dining room table overturned, loud voices. 3 years later, that baby was so aggressive in childcare that they could not keep him in a childcare setting. When you experience that kind of trauma as an infant, what happens is the brain is flooded with cortisol, and while your motor development, your ability to sit and crawl and walk, may develop typically for our children, the social, emotional, and the speech does not develop typically. And nationwide, we now know that in Part C programs or the birth to three home visiting infant learning programs nationwide, 83% of those children are speech delayed. And I say speech delayed because speech delay ties to trauma. When you're an infant, what can you withhold? You can refuse to eat. You can refuse to poop. You can refuse to speak. We know that a lot of those speech delayed kids are trauma kids. We are committed. Our system is evolving, and we are committed to wanting to work with those families, provide resources, provide support, provide options, provide parent training, help mothers in those situations and fathers understand what's happening in their child's brain when those events take place. We can see changes in the family functioning. We are evolving. That evolution last year looked like a 22% increase for evaluations in our programs. 22%, that's like a quarter increase of the number of kids. And our program was struggling to offer those services before. So I'm here to say how much we appreciate Governor Parnell's Choose Respect campaign and his acknowledging that with a $1.5 million increment that he calls CAPTA inclusion, which is a way of referring to families where there has been substantiated abuse and neglect with a child. And we are committed to wanting to serve those children, and we so appreciate the resources to be able to do that. And the one other thing, have you ever heard of ACEs study? Do you know what the ACEs study is? Hallelujah. Okay, adverse childhood experiences. We know now substantially, Kaiser Permanente in California, 7,000 insurees were willing to share what kind of adverse childhood experiences they'd had. Parent incarcerated, substance abuse, emotional neglect, physical violence in the home. We know that not only is there a tie to developmental disabilities with those effects, but there is even a mortality tie. In other words, clearly there is more smoking in that population, there's higher substance abuse, but people literally die earlier from those adverse childhood effects. We are committed as a program to evolve into assisting to minimize, build family resilience, build support, build knowledge in families to decrease and work with those adverse childhood effects. So we urge you to keep that $1.5 million increment that is already in the budget. And we thank you. And I just want to say one more personal word. And my personal word is I so honor the fact that you each have been willing to take on the mantle of responsibility that we out in the public go, well, wait a minute, you should. And I so honor that you've been willing to take on that responsibility and move that forward. And I thank each of you for being our face in public government. Thank you.
Thank you. Further. Any questions from the committee? No?
I wish I'd had some slides with numbers like the brain thing. That was really impressive. That was cool.
Well, I really appreciate you coming forward and with your presentation, and especially all the hard work that you guys do in your respective, you know, departments and what you do to help people. We're doing our best as we can up here, but in reality of it, you guys are really doing the work. And I want you to understand that. My respect to you for that.
And to the families.
Okay. Yep. And to the families. All right. We'll go brief at ease then. We're back in order again. right, today we have HB 90 vitamin D supplement sponsored by Representative Seaton, which is at the table. And I guess, let's see here, we're going to entertain a motion to adopt committee substitute HB 90 version U as the working document. And if I don't have any objections, we can move forward. Is that correct?
That's right. That's yep.
Exactly right. Mr. Chair, I'd move HB 90, the blank CS version U.
Okay. Well, hearing no objections to the CS before us, for the we can hear it for the purpose of discussion. The floor is now yours, Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I appreciate being able to bring this to your attention today. First thing that I'd like to do is give you a little background, and you have before you a yellow sheet, which is HCR5, which was passed in the 27th legislature unanimously by the House and the Senate. We looked at about 40 different medical conditions, and those and in that, what we asked on the resolves is, first of all, we had it resolved that the Alaska State Legislature respectfully requests that the governor establish prevention of disease as a primary model of health care in Alaska. And in the further resolves, our last one was to promote vitamin D supplements for pregnant women and infants to prevent pregnancy complications, preterm births, type 1 diabetes, and rickets. And Mr. Chairman, you also have a card, a little rack card with you. And I just wanted to point out that HCR5 is on my website, housemajority.org/Seaton. And on that website, every one of those studies is actually linked. So if one goes to that website and looks at seasonal affective disorder and how vitamin D treats it, you just click on it and it brings up the peer-reviewed scientific study showing that, or the 50% less cancer. You click on that and it brings up the peer-reviewed scientific study. So all of those studies are available, and they're available to any member of the legislature who wants that linked version for their website as well. So with that introduction, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to bring up what we have today is based on new research that has come out since 2011. And specifically what we're looking at is some research that it was just published in February of this last year, in February 2012, in Pediatrics, which is, you know, the major journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And this is an Australian study that was done, and it involved about 743 Caucasian women in Perth, Australia, and their mother-infant pairs. What they did was they looked at measuring the vitamin D level in the second trimester of pregnancy, and then they followed these kids for 17 years, and it was done over a long period of time. And what they found was this graph, and I'm just, by the way, you have the full complete research paper under tab 4, but this is the main graph that I wanted to bring to your attention. It's kind of busy because it's got two ages, age 5 and age 10, but you can see those gray bars at the top. And one thing that Australia does is every child when they go into school at age 5 is assessed for language receptivity based on the Peabody scale, a normal normal language tool that they use. And you'll see it's pretty much similar, but you'll see in the black bars there's a huge difference. And if we pull that graph apart slightly, you'll see here is at age 5. So all of these are age 5, and you see on the left-hand side is the lowest quartile, meaning they took all of these women, they all had assessments of their vitamin D level, they split them into fourths. So you had the top fourth and the bottom fourth, and you'll notice that those that were basically above 30 nanograms per milliliter, which those are added on because they use the European nanomoles per liter, which two different scales, but we've converted that into that box down there. So basically above 30 is the top quartile, top one-fourth of the women, and the bottom fourth of the women, anywhere between 16 and 18, basically below 20, is that bottom fourth of the women. And you'll notice the top fourth, the higher levels of vitamin D, they had 3% of their children identified with moderate to severe language impairment. And in the bottom fourth of the women that were in their second trimester sampled as having low vitamin D, 13% of their kids were identified with severe to moderate language difficulty. Now remember, there's no following these kids. I mean, these are kind of like double-blind random controls. They don't know. I mean, it's just following the kids based on that blood samples that were taken earlier. And then what we do is we look at, well, how malleable is that? How much improvement can you get? And in Australia, at age 10, they redo language assessments again. And you'll notice that here, even after 5 years of school intervention, the bottom quartile, bottom fourth, those mothers that had low vitamin D have 2.25 times more kids still with severe to moderate language impairment than those that had adequate vitamin D. And this is at Perth, Australia, 32 degrees south latitude, 32 degrees off of the equator. Alaska is anywhere from 53 to 71 degrees off the equator. And why that's important is because almost all the vitamin D that we get, we manufacture in our skin through sun exposure. And that's noontime sun exposure, between 10 and 2. Because if the sun is low on the horizon, all of the ultraviolet B radiation is absorbed when it's coming through the atmosphere. And so, of course, if you're closer to the equator, you get a lot more overhead sunshine. And so you would expect that the vitamin D levels in Perth, Australia, are going to be much better than far north where we are up here in Alaska. So this implication from this 2012 study might be huge for us up here. So what we are going to look at now is another study that came out in September of this last year. It was a shorter term study. They were looking at mental and psychomotor development, among other things, at age 14 months in kids, but they measured the mother's blood level again in the second trimester of pregnancy. And what they found was that there are several things. One, they looked at over time when the samples were in the course of a year, because they've got 1,800 mothers that they're doing over a long course of several years, and those second trimester of pregnancy occurs at different times depending upon when conception occurred, and also there is that factor, as well as looking at what the development is. So one thing that's very important is, if you see this slide here, excuse me, the cold is still there. At least I got a little of my voice back. You'll see that up here in Valencia, Spain, there were four cities at different latitudes in Spain. And the one that had the highest latitude has the highest proportion of people that have over 30 nanograms per milliliter, which is basically the same cutoff point that the prior study from Australia looked at. And as you come down, you can see these lowering percentages of the people from those latitudes that were in this upper group. So that was important. And the other thing that was important is, you can see over here, those that were had above 30 had a 2.6 advantage on mental score and 2.3 on psychomotor scores. And those were at 14 months of age. So that this sine wave graph down at the bottom, you can see during the summer there was adequate vitamin D. All during the winter there was lower vitamin D levels. And of course, our start of this low time of light exposure is much less, because again, these were at 39 to 43 latitude instead of 53 to 71. One more study that I wanted to bring out to you was this mother-infant pair study that was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, latitude 40. And the interesting thing was they were looking at birth and what the, basically using those same levels of deficiency and sufficiency, 94% of the 200 mothers that were the black mothers with infants, and 66% of the Caucasian mother-infant pairs were low. Here's a blow-up of the slide from there, and you can see that it's interesting that what we're really looking at is this is cord blood, so this is the baby's levels of vitamin D, and this is the mother's and mothers at birth. So you can see the very big correlation between the second trimester and the cord blood at birth. So what's important about this is we're trying to figure out how can we figure out where Alaska is. These have important ramifications for us. And the reason we're looking at black women and white women is pigment in the skin, something that blocks the absorption of UVB rays, definitely influences the amount of vitamin D that will be in a child. And what we have up here is we wear long sleeves almost all summer, keeping off mosquitoes and things, which is basically artificial pigment. In other words, serves the same purpose of having pigment in the skin. Pigment in the skin is very useful if you're on the equator because you don't want too much vitamin D, but that's what, when you're far north with pigment or with long sleeves, you don't make vitamin D because you're not exposing your skin to sunshine. A few other things, and I just threw these in because there's some questions about what are the other effects of vitamin D. Here's a book that just came out in 2011, and it's Environment, Mood Disorders, and Suicide Relations, and this whole chapter 5 is looking at that. We have a study that just came out from the military and looking at 495 controls by rank, sex, and age. These were completed suicides. They paired those with 495 similar men and women in rank, rank, sex, and where they were, and looked at those. They did not find any difference between those as far as their vitamin D levels and the suicides, but they did find that if you had low vitamin D, the risk was twice as much for completing suicide as if you didn't have low vitamin D. So a big important study. And then here's another one that also worked on was looking at the military, and there's another study that just found that in South Carolina, people undergoing basic training, after 8 weeks of basic training, their vitamin D status had fallen dramatically because of the heavy clothes. So again, something blocking absorption and manufacture of vitamin D. One other study that I've given you here, and that is an intervention study, a double-blind randomized control study in Sweden. And what they looked at was, and this was just in, I think it's October of 2012. And what they did was they had these people that were immune compromised, and so they had a lot of respiratory infections per year. And then they split them in two groups. One group they gave 4,000 IU a day, and the other group they gave a placebo for a full year. And what they found was that those that were taking the vitamin D at that level had 23% reduction in the infection rate and significantly 60% less use of antibiotics by those people that were taking the vitamin D. Now, this is a double-blind randomized control study, so nobody knew what. They're just going back at the end and looking at the effects of that. So what are we trying to do in Alaska? We're looking at these kind of effects. And so what we want to do is find out, are we like Perth, Australia? What is the status of vitamin D in infants? In Alaska, we have about 10,000 babies, 11,000 babies per year born in Alaska. And the purpose of this bill is to do a one-year study and at birth assess the vitamin D level of infants. We have no idea of what the population and subpopulation at birth level of vitamin D is in our state. If we are looking at a causality problem of low vitamin D in the second trimester, when the brain is developing its language centers, and with low vitamin D, if that's not happening, then what we have is potentially some very severe consequences for Alaska. But we have no idea if our distribution is a fourth, like Perth, Australia, where there's a fourth of them above 30, or we may only have 5% that are above 30, and we may be well weighted to the lower end. That's normally what's thought, is that the further north you are or the further south you are, New Zealand has the same kind of problem in New Zealand, because it again is far south of the equator. You don't get the sunshine, you don't make the vitamin D, so there's some real problems. Anyway, that's what we're looking at. You've got some other things in there in your packet. You've got a commitment from Grassroots Health and the University of South Carolina that does laboratory or does randomized controlled trials around the world, and that they will provide us at about half price by two drop spot tests for vitamin D for $30 a piece, so it's about a $300,000 to find out what is the level of vitamin D in Alaska. Now, I want to be clear, we're not trying through this study to establish what the proper level is. You know, there is some debate. Should it be 30? Should it be 20? We're not trying to establish that with this study. We're trying to establish what is the level of vitamin D in newborns across Alaska. You know, as we go through that debate and figure out what that will be, we can see how we want to make people aware of what the potentials are. And you know, just for relative talking, if vitamin D in second trimester is causally associated with language impairment, the effect for Alaska is, if we would move the lower three quadrants to everybody over 30, if we had the same distribution as Perth, Australia, we'd be talking about 400 kids a year less going into kindergarten or first grade with severe to moderate language impairment. Severe to moderate language impairment is the second largest disability category, language impairment, in Alaska. There's over 3,000 kids in Alaska that are diagnosed with severe to moderate language impairment, and there's a whole other group that have multiple impairments, and some of those will be there. But just singly as language impairment, there's over 3,000. So, Mr. Chairman, the ongoing cause of trying to prevent to promote health in Alaska is what this is about, trying to establish what is our baseline, what do we have in Alaska, and how does that relate to what would be helpful for us to know and to improve the health and education of Alaskan children. So I think that basically identifies what the bill's about, what we're trying to do here. And so one thing that I would like to point out, in the very back of your packet, the last sheet, is something that just came from Eric Gephardt, the superintendent of the Enana School District. Since we passed HCR 5 2 years ago, they looked at that and said, gee, is there something we can do? And this year, what they did is they went and said to their parents, because it's a residential school, they said, do you want to have us give your kids 1,000 IU of vitamin D a day? Totally voluntary, totally with parental permission. And again, these are not prescription drugs, these are supplements. And they had a number that said yes. And if you... Okay, I'm sorry we don't have that on a slide, but if you look at that back sheet, you'll see that The on the left-hand column is the kids that are participating in taking vitamin D. And let me just read off a couple. The number of absent days due to illness. And the school nurse just went through and pulled out all these things and just got them to us. 40% of the kids had 0 days absence, 11 had 1 day, 5% had 2, 11 had 3 days absence, 17 had 4, 11 had 6, and 5% had 6 days absence. That was the most days that were missed for those that were taking the vitamin D. If you look on the other side, you had 26% of the kids instead of 40% had 0 days of absence, 14 had 1 day, and I'll just skip down. You know, we had five that had 6 days in the people who were taking vitamin D and nobody longer. And now we have 4% that have 8 days, 2% 9, 4% 10, and 2% have 12 days of absence in the category that was not taking vitamin D. So the absent rates, percentage rates, down there at the bottom, 3.2% of the days were missed by the group that were not taking vitamin D, and 2.4 were the absence of due to illness for those that were taking vitamin D. Something that might even be more interesting to you is if you look down on the bottom, you'll see that there were 8 of those students that are taking vitamin D that attended last year as well when they were not taking vitamin D. And last year when they were not taking vitamin D, 25% of the kids had no days absence, and you can see there were 12.5% of the kids had 13 days that were missed. For this year, 62.5% of the kids with taking those same 8 kids had 0 days absence, and the most was 12.5% that had 4 days. So although the numbers of days are slightly different, if you look down at the very bottom, you'll see that the percentage of days missed is 2.5% of those same kids last year, the number of days that they missed, and now it's 1.1% of their days that are missed for illness. So that's the most recent data that we have. It really doesn't correspond directly to, you know, assessing babies. And I did want to mention one more thing on the assessment of the babies. This is to be done with cord blood. So at birth, you know, after the cord is tied and cut, there's blood left in the cord, which is the baby's blood. So this doesn't require a taking blood or a heel stick or anything else from a baby. It just would use 2 drops of the cord blood taken at the same time as they do other tests, because we do other tests, but not required to do by Health and Social Services. So, Mr. Chairman, I've probably talked enough for then, but I sure appreciate the opportunity to present the bill and be happy to try and answer any questions you have.
Oh. Representative Bramble.
Thank you. You made me a believer in really trying to pay attention to vitamin D levels. I do have a question. Of course, budgets are a big issue. I don't know what the fiscal note or anything is on this bill yet, but what my question is, don't we already test vitamin K now? And I'm not sure if this would be very much of an increase in cost if we're just, you know, testing for
We do a number of tests,
right,
and those tests are specific for heritable genetic disorders. And so that's a restriction in statute for heritable genetic disorders. This is a test for vitamin D, which they do not do. And so, and it's not a heritable condition. It's actually a condition of not getting enough sunshine, not the mother not having adequate vitamin D in her body, because, of course, the newborn was totally dependent upon the mother for the vitamin D, and we saw that in the study that was done in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, between the mother-infant pairs, the black mother-infant pairs and the Caucasian infant pairs. So they're both totally dependent upon the mother for their vitamin D.
Go ahead. Follow.
I'm sorry. Thank you. So I guess what my question is there a fiscal note in regards to this? I mean, I know it's a $2.7 billion for HESS right now, and with our emphasis on prevention, maybe we can get that down if we start doing things differently. I'm just trying to figure out the risk-benefit cost analysis.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the $300,000 is, we've gotten this severely constrained from where it would be if it went through the Department of Health and Social Services. Their estimate would be much higher. It costs them $287 per test, plus taking the sample and all. This being a temporary law, it's, we, like I say, we've gotten a really good offer for having these tests done and the initial analysis. There is probably going to be come forward an amendment, because right now the bill specifies that Department of Health and Social Services would do this. We have a offer from the university, and we are also working with the Hospital Association, both, including the state epidemiologists, think this would be great information for us to have. We're trying to do it at the least cost that we can for the state, and with the least. Department of Health and Social Services also felt if they were going to add this, they would have to pass regulations, and that would probably delay, by the time they'd get regulations passed to implement a law, might put it off another year. So we think that we can work with one of those two institutions to get us there.
Okay. Couple of questions. You may or may not know the answers to this. On your first test or articles that you showed us, who paid for those studies? From Australia, Spain, and the other one. Do you know?
Well, this was the and the first one from let me see. Let me just pull it back up here. This was done by White House and those guys at, I'm not sure which university it was. I can.
Well, they did this. They did the study, but who paid for it?
Oh, I have no idea. I can try and find out for you.
Okay, that would be helpful. You know, and that's going to lead me to my second question, is that any studies that we do on behalf of the vitamin D industry, you would think that they would help foot the bill for that. And, you know, in my opinion, you know, that because it's, you know, it's going to help them out, and obviously we're looking at it for the health, for us, for our benefits. So I would like to, you know, get some sort of response from that, or how that's going to work. As far as that goes, and being in the health field, I do know that studies you got to be careful with, you know, and you have to look at, you know, who paid for the study to begin with. That's the first question I always ask, no matter who's it for, because you'll find out that eventually it rolls back around for like Procter and Gamble, or, you know, things like that. You know, it comes out to their benefit as we go through that. So the other problem that I've got, and this is a problem that you will run into, and that is, if the study comes out that, yeah, you're right, we need vitamin D, this is really going to help us, you can't force anyone to take vitamin D. And so what's the end product here? I mean, what's the end result of what you're trying to accomplish?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, let me address the last one. The last one is exactly like we addressed in HCR5. We are trying to make the people of Alaska and the health system aware of what can we do to improve health in Alaska. Unless the people of Alaska and the mothers of Alaska know whether they are low in vitamin D and need to be taking vitamin D, they're not going to be doing it. If the implication is, as we've seen from the Spanish and the Australian study, that we can have severe impacts on our educational and the kids of Alaska, we need people to know that. And so,
well, I guess
there's no attempt here to mandate that we go in and say everybody must do something. But unless people are aware, and we don't even know what the level is. We now know from the studies that are coming out here that they're at a 20-year study, there's severe impacts possible.
Well, I guess, you know, getting back to that point is, you have, and I appreciate your enthusiasm on vitamin D, There's a plenty of studies that show that, you know, in your opinion, that it's going to be helpful to you. So, you know, technically, you could go out there right now and say, hey, we need to start doing vitamin D for everybody. In fact, you've told me that several times. So, you know, it's like, do we need to do another study to say that? You know, that's my question, is it really worth doing that? And then who is going to do that campaign for us? Is the state going to foot that bill too, that campaign, to get out there to tell people to get vitamin D? Do you see where I'm going with this? It's like, I think the state has a responsibility for good health. There's no doubt about it. And we should do whatever we can to make that happen. But a specific industry that wants to come in, I do think that it's their responsibility to also do their part too. It's not just on the state's budget.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do agree with you. And that's one of the problems with these vitamin D studies, is that there's no money in it. Pharma is not patentable. If it was patentable and you were looking at these results would be published. There'd be the clinical trials, and there would be lots of money could flow to things. I mean, the 5,000 IU vitamin D that I distributed 2 years ago to members of the legislature, and will again, there's 500 of those, 5,000 IU, year and a half supply, and it was $12. So the amount of money in that is darn near zero. I mean, you can go to Amazon.com and they have these, the droppers that per drop is 2,000 IU of vitamin D. There's 900 drops and it's $18. 3 years of supply for, you know, a kid at 2,000 IU per day. And I say 2,000 IU a day because that's what the Finnish study did when they were looking at type 1 diabetes, and 80% reduction of type 1 diabetes ever occurring if the kids had 2,000 IU a day. There's not much money in that. And so pharma was here, and they like to help, kind of, but, you know, they don't have anybody that's out there championing something that can't be patented. I mean, that's not their job. Their job is to patent medicines and to promote what they're able to make money on. And so something that is not patentable, you know, that you can make in your own skin, is one of those kind of orphan things. It's not a drug, it's a hormone that you make and you utilize. It's really not a technical vitamin, it's a pro-hormone. So I will be happy to find out as much as I can who funded those studies that were in pediatrics. As you know, what happens is research labs all around do, this was long, longitudinal study. I imagine it was done by the government of Australia. They're not generally 17-year longitudinal studies looking at all lots of health parameters based on, you know, it's not like a drug. There needs to be a faster turnaround for those kind of funding. But I don't know, and I will get back to you on that and find out.
Thank you. I would appreciate it. Yeah. Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm really supportive. And I think, you know, a couple of different things we've heard today it have the potential to affect education outcomes. And I guess my only suggestion would be to somehow, you know, link the Department of Education or the university program for public health or something into this, the work that would be done here to, you know, encourage maybe further research on efforts that could, you know, both on the medical side and the education side be done, or just somehow kind of combining those pieces of information, because I think what we might learn, you know, from this, or what was mentioned earlier with the complex trauma, for example, is just that maybe some of our problems in the school system, you know, and student performance are actually related to these other health issues, and so it'd be nice to be able to see those pieces of information come together to answer those questions.
And thank you. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, appreciate that. And the president of the university did come down. He was very interested in this. He is going back to their departments and looking in conjunction, we've also been in contact with, Dr. Abel Boltito with his, if I could introduce my staffer.
Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Tanika Hansen, staff representative Seton, and we were in contact with Dr. Abel Boltito from the university, and he is a PhD he's a behavioral neuroscientist that looks a lot at human anatomy and physiology, and he's very interested in the effects of vitamin B he's looked at animal and human studies.
And that letter from him is in your letter references in the supporting documents.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Representative Seton, for this good information. Very interesting. Appreciate it. Old professors never die. You know, I mean, it's a good. You taught us. Last year when you brought us up, and I've been on vitamin D ever since. So I just want to say it's effective getting this information out there, and I want to thank you for that. Talk to me a little bit more about the. This is. I mean, your concept is it just, just measuring infant vitamin D, no longitudinal element to this at all, do you expect it to stay there? Claire, I might have missed something that you said or whatever, but talk to me again about the fiscal note. Is there a fiscal note coming forward on this, and you think that $300,000 will be it? I just didn't quite get the details of it.
There, the $300,000 is the cost to analyze the samples and to do the analysis based on the survey that'll come out, looking at all those things about which area the pregnancy occurred in, where the majority of the pregnancy was, whether someone went on to Hawaii on vacation during that time, whether they're taking vitamin D supplements, so that we have the information to relate to that. So that's that portion. The other portion is going to depend on who actually in the end does it. If it is the hospital association, if they decide to do that, or if it is the university or the Department of Health and Social Services. Right now the bill says the Department of Health and Social Services, and they have not fully generated fiscal note on it, on what they would need to do. Again, we're not trying to establish what levels people should have. We're just trying to establish what baseline is here. People can opt out, just like they can out of vaccinations, just like they can out of the other blood tests. The requirement is there, but they can opt out. So if someone doesn't want to participate, if a mother wants to find out the vitamin D level, they'll be able to opt into that on the form that they do, so that they'll be able. I mean, we don't want to deny people the information, but this is all HIPAA compliant. It's all been done through, what is the Western? There's a institutional review board process that has to go through to assure that research is being done appropriately and all that kind of stuff. I think it was called the
Western Institutional Review Board, which is considered a worldwide accepted board.
And it may need to go through also, and I presented to the Native Health Board. Although this isn't a Native study, it's all Alaskan. Those subpopulations will be assessed, and so those subpopulations will be able to will know where those are in the aggregate, and so we've talked to them about going through the Native Institutional Review Board as well, and so we will.
Go ahead.
On page 1 down 11 or 12 it says it's for testing the vitamin D levels of newborns at birth or as soon after birth as possible. And then I think you just indicated that it would also include like at least a survey or something of the mother and the family, you know. So what I guess what I'm struggling with in my mind is, if we're contracting out on this, just how broad the you anticipate the test to be. I mean, not that I mean, I'm just wondering if the language in the bill is limiting compared to what you're thinking, or is it? Am I missing something? Because it very specifically talks about the vitamin D level at birth. It doesn't say anything about mother.
Thank you, Representative Keller, through the chair. This is not a longitudinal study.
Right.
There is nothing in here that goes and follows those kids for 20 years. I mean, they're, you know, we're not doing anything like that. If a researcher would want to do that in the future, they would have to come and contact each mother that, unless the mothers had voluntarily said, we want to be included in future studies. So at this, we're not doing anything other than trying to find out what the vitamin D level is in different regions. I mean, Ketchikan may be very different than Fairbanks, than Barrow and Kotzebue. That knowledge is really important, you know, to people to, in those communities, to be able to assess that.
Sure.
The Native Health Board, ANTC, community health centers may very appropriately want to know what their local levels are, mm-hmm. because they may want to independently adjust it, but there's nothing in here or no intention to mandate that everybody in the state does something.
Just one quick. Yeah, that I was just wondering what your intent was. I mean, anybody that looks at this data, you know, you can't help but be curious what's going to happen if we get a baseline, you know, what's going to happen in 10 years. You know, I can see the curiosity, but I see your intent now is very specific, and of course, we don't know, you know, what the parents in that year, they may be solicited for other tests, but you know, that's not here or there. That has nothing to do with the bill. So
that's yeah. Through the chair, that's correct. This is a 1 year only temporary statute. It's not an ongoing, but it will give us the information for Alaska so that Alaskans and the healthcare people in each region of Alaska can make determinations for themselves.
Go ahead. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you just answered it. I wanted to clarify because I was looking on the second page, and of course part of the under the program established under this section must include a procedure for, and then number four was permitting a mother of a newborn to refuse testing if serologic testing is contrary to the tenets or practice of the religious creed of the mother. I was trying to make sure, are we going to be mandating this over the course of the year for every child that's born, that unless you've got a concern that's religious, are we pretty much saying that every child will be tested?
The purpose of this is, unless a mother opts out, yes. The requirement is for the healthcare professionals that are attending. If they're not a healthcare professional attending, you know, that's why we're thinking it's going to be 10,000 instead of 10,800 babies in a year, because there are going to be a number that aren't going to be here just because they're remote, cord blood, it won't be available later. Could be heel stick. We put in here heel stick or cord blood. Cord blood is the preferred option that we have, but in some cases, people might want to participate and it may be 2 or 3 days later, and so they could use that same when they do the heel stick for the heritable diseases, which are generally done within after 48 hours, they could use that. That's not our intent, but we didn't want to limit that possibility.
Okay. No, thank you. I appreciate it. And just kind of to continue dialogue, it's obvious, there's so much that goes on when a child's being born, and you know how that just the paperwork and whatnot. Just curious if that was something that we almost need to make we'll need to make sure that the healthcare provider is letting them know that it's coming up. So that, and I'm trying to remember when our kids were born, there was a bunch of stuff those last couple of days. So we definitely don't want them coming back afterwards and saying, hey, I didn't know about this, just because there's so much going on. We'll probably have to I'm thinking there may be a cost associated with it, making sure that there is an understanding out there that this is going to be coming up if your child's born through X period of time, whether it's communication through the healthcare providers or however we would go about that. And there's a potential, and then of course there's potential costs associated with that. So,
and through the chair, yes, I totally agree. And this is for healthcare providers to do the survey, you know, fill out the information with the pregnant mother at the time, close to the time of delivery. Some of the stuff is after delivery because you have birth weight and birth length and, you know, those kind of parameters and how the birth was conducted. So anyway, that's the intent, that this would be done with cord blood. They do some tests with cord blood anyway, so it's not something that is different than the nurses would be performing. So it could be done simultaneously, but the Department of Health and Services didn't want it basically in conjunction or through that exact process requirement, because then you get into regulations, and we're just doing a statutory.
We got to follow up.
No, just one final thing then. Then back to, and I think you talked a little bit about the university, the association here. Why go through the process of having it go through the state and Health and Human Services instead of it being something that is done through the university, maybe UAF or UAA, and have them do it? Why go through it in this manner?
And through the chair, Representative Pruitt, you're exactly right. That's what I said, that, you know, we're not asking for this bill to be moved today at all.
Right. Yeah, okay.
But one of the things that we'll be looking at is making those changes so it would be done simultaneously or in conjunction, but not in conjunction with the other tests, but okay, would be done at the same time. And then also, it may well be that the university or the hospital association would be a better outfit to work on this. And like I say, we're having those conversations right now, but I really appreciate getting the hearing so that we can get feedback from the general public. I mean, there is no, I mean, people can opt out, but unless we know what the distribution is across all the different subpopulations in Alaska, we're not going to be able to look at problems.
Yeah, after
you want
one last piece to that.
The last one was your last one.
Yeah, I know. you'd still need the legislation though if you gave it to the university, right? Because you'd still need that year of it's mandated, even if the university is actually running it. Is that what I was getting from that?
Through the chair, that's exactly correct.
Okay, great. That was it.
Representative Seaton, you know, one of the things I would like to see first, you know, before is how the study would be done, because you know, we live in a unique state. This, what you're talking about, is considered a sunshine vitamin, and bottom line is you go to Barrow, trust me, their numbers are going to be different than Fairbanks. Fairbanks numbers are going to be different than Anchorage. Juneau's numbers are going to be different than us. So it would be, because you have to have a baseline. Unfortunately, I was forced to work in the research department for 6 months at Creighton. So I understand how you do research and studies. And without a definite baseline, none of these numbers are going to work. You know, nobody, and so it would be interesting to see how the study would be done to begin with so that the numbers are accurate and reliable, for one thing, because our state is so diverse with sunshine that it would be, for me, I would be interested to even see how they even do the study to begin with and make it so that the numbers could be quantitative, you know, for one. So, but that was just my comment on the study.
And Mr. Chairman, we do have a draft of a survey, you know, trying to, I mean, there are surveys that are done with international studies, clinical trials, and we cut those down to get most of the superfluous stuff out. But we're also doing, there's check boxes for regions, and then circle the city that was closest to where you are to get those baselines. And yeah, I mean, if we just said this is Alaska and it's all one pot, that's why I'm saying we've got subpopulations, and ethnic, I mean, you know, we have a large South Pacific Islander population in Anchorage, and that population may have very different levels than, you know, Caucasian or Native or Hispanic levels in Anchorage. And so those, that information would be on there. You know, this is all HIPAA compliant. We're not going to be able to say Johnny here and know where he is, but, you know, looking at those subpopulation levels is exactly what we're trying, what you're talking about is exactly what we're trying to do through that, that would be filled out by the healthcare provider and the mother, you know, close to the time of birth.
Well, I appreciate you being on the hot seat. But is there anyone else you would like to bring forward, or any more questions from the committee?
No, they're all traveling.
Mr. Chairman, we had two doctors that wanted to call in that, you know, we've been working with a number of doctors and professionals and the Native Health Board a little bit when presented to them on refining the survey so it's applicable and has the proper opt-outs.
Okay. Well, we have a Ward Hilbert online. Is that, do you want him to talk? Because he didn't say if he wants to test for that. Would you like him to
if he,
come online?
I think
he was online for
questions. Yes, sir.
Okay, well, we've got you online, so your name and your position for us, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chairman Dinkins. My name is Ward Hurlbert. I'm the Chief Medical Officer with the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm basically on to answer questions. The administration does not have a position on the bill. Representative Seaton and I have talked and are in concurrence that the proposed study would provide data on what the vitamin D level is. In terms of what are normal vitamin D levels, and in terms of what many, many people who are very enthusiastic about the potential for vitamin D help, if you look at the data from the United States Preventive Services Task Force, the National Institutes of Health, the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research, private agencies like the Cochrane Collaborative and Hayes, the Institute of Medicine, all of those entities will state that one, vitamin D is essential. Two, it is clearly a factor in bone health, like rickets, like osteoporosis, like helping with falls and fractures in the elderly and with certain genetically determined uncommon bone conditions, but there is disagreement with literally all of the other issues that folks who sincerely are very enthusiastic and believe that it helps, whether it's cancer, whether it's diabetes, whether it's the intellectual development, multiple sclerosis, that the data, after reviewing the thousands of articles, does not support those conclusions.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chairman Higgins.
So, well, with that said, then I guess, do you want me to open this up to public testimony on the floor? Would that be fine? Or
be fine with me.
Okay. All right. Well, let's do that. At this time, if there's anybody in the audience that would like to testify, this would be your opportunity to do it on this bill. Right now, we're just hearing it. We're not going to pass it through. We just want to hear comment if you have it. Okay. Hearing no one coming forth, and I think that's we don't have anybody else online, correct? We're good? Okay. Well, with that said, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave public testimony open, okay, so that the next time we hear the bill, we can do that. And what we're going to do is set this bill aside for right now, and we'll come back to it later on. And with that, we are about done. Our next HES committee meeting will be at 3 p.m. on February the 26th. We'll begin next week's meeting with the presentation from the Alaska Citizens Review Panel, which will be followed by the first hearing of HB 54, Placement of Child in Need of Aid. It is now 4:55 p.m., and today's meeting is adjourned. Thank you.